Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
As Foreign Minister Boris Johnson's loose lips sunk the hopes of a British citizen imprisoned in Iran. Now, as Prime Minister, can he handle the crisis with Iran in the Persian Gulf? I talked to the former Foreign Secretary, Jack Straw. Then...
You're better than those racists.
I don't know what to do.
Based on a true story of redemption, a new film portrays how a neo-Nazi scrubbed his facial tattoos and turned his back on the white supremacist movement with the help of a black social activist. And the Wall Street Journal editor-in-chief Matt Murray in conversation with our Walter Isaacson.
Welcome to the programme, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. A momentous week in British politics saw one Prime Minister leave Downing Street and another move in. Boris Johnson's cabinet ministers have been appointed now, taking a radical right turn at the very top of government, with hardline Brexiteers put in all the senior positions. And in his first address to the House of Commons, he spoke with his usual bombast, promising his premiership was a fresh start.
Mr. Speaker, today is the first day of a new approach, which will end with our exit from the EU on the 31st of October. Then I hope we can have a friendly and constructive relationship as constitutional equals, as friends and partners in facing the challenges that lie ahead.
Leaving the EU will be the toughest and most dramatic peacetime British operation. But Johnson also has serious issues to deal with even further afield, such as the crisis with Iran and the tit-for-tat seizure of oil tankers. Jack Straw is a former British Foreign Secretary. And in 2001, after 9/11, he became the first top minister to visit Iran since the 1979 revolution. His intense study of this vital yet vexing nation is the subject of his latest book, The English Job, Understanding Iran and Why It Distrusts Britain. It looks at the two countries' complicated relationship over many decades. And I've been speaking to Straw about this indispensable guide and the role Britain has played in shaping Iran's domestic and foreign policy. Former Foreign Secretary Jack Straw, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You have really built quite a name for yourself in that you are one of the rare Iran experts in the sort of field of public servants who actually have to deal with the country. You've now written this book and we're going to delve into it. But first I want to ask you, what do you make of the current crisis, which is essentially tit-for-tat seizing of tankers and particularly Iran seizing the British flagged tanker?
Well, I mean, what I make of that is absolutely classic Iranian approach. They're up against the wall, not least because of President Trump's sanctions. They're pretty desperate. They know the risks of getting into a full-scale war, which they would lose straight away. So they're doing their best to calibrate things. And I think it followed, as night followed the day, that once the tanker in Gibraltar was arrested, there was bound to be retaliation. I mean, it was inevitable.
And that was apparently an Iranian tanker taking oil...
to
busting
Syria.
The sanctions to Syria.
I mean, this goes back, of course, to Donald Trump's decision to withdraw from the JCPOA. I happen to think that that was the wrong decision. I'm on the same page as President Trump in not wanting Iran to build a nuclear weapon. I think we all are. And there are big risks about what Iran's real intentions are. But I just happened to think it was crazy for him to pull out of this deal, which guaranteed that Iran effectively could not build a nuclear weapons capability for 15 years, and replace it by nothing directly. One of the things it's done...
So it's made it more dangerous. In fact, pulling out of the... You call it, well, the formal name is JCPOA, but the Iran nuclear deal has actually potentially made it more likely that Iran could, if it wanted to.
I don't think there's any doubt about that, first off.
So it's made it more dangerous for
the
region.
And one of the reasons it's done that is because it has shifted the balance of politics in Iran. Now, I know there are people here, as well as in the US, people like John Bolton, for example, in the US, who take the view that this is an entirely homogenous government, There are no arguments inside the government, and it's all one lot controlled by mullahs, to quote them. But it's much more complicated than that.
So what you're basically saying is that the US is alienating the pragmatic core of the Iran and not even recognising that there is a pragmatic wing, and empowering the most hardline, which is the Iranian Revolutionary Guard.
And one of the great ironies of this is that the hardliners in the Revolutionary Guards around Khamenei were always opposed to the nuclear deal.
So they've got what they want.
So here you have a Faustian pact between President Trump and the hardliners. And the other miscalculation by John Bolton and President Trump was that if they impose these sanctions, which in turn have unquestionably caused huge damage to the Iranian economy, to living standards for most Iranians, this would cause an uprising and unrest. But it's not like that, because just as when the Iran-Iraq war took place, the hardliners were able to take control, so yet again, they've been able to control and take control and appeal, amongst other things, to national pride and national unity.
So let me ask you, because, you know, you are a former foreign secretary. You had to deal with Iran, you know, certainly in the post 9/11 period and all of that. And now a British former foreign secretary is prime minister, Boris Johnson. And you've got Javad Zarif, the Iranian foreign minister, having tweeted that I congratulate my former counterpart, Boris Johnson, on becoming UK prime minister. Iran does not seek confrontation, but we have 1,500 miles of Persian Gulf coastline. These are our waters and we will protect them. What do you think this is going to lead to? What does that mean? Does Boris Johnson know how to deal with this?
Well, in fairness to the guy, and even if I'd been in the Tory party, I wouldn't have voted for him. He handled Iran as foreign secretary okay. He took advice. I used to talk to him from time to time about this, and he stuck with the deal and was very clear about that. I hope very much that he does not respond to blandishments from President Trump that we'll give you a trade deal, but you split away from the Europeans. But so far, so good. So far as the tankers are concerned, this is very straightforward. The Iranians, even in good times, are transactional. Mm-hmm. You take my tanker, we'll take yours. So there have to be a deal at some stage. It may be over a period of weeks where it's agreed with honour that both are released.
You know, you brought up the fact that the current new Prime Minister Boris Johnson is kind of really hitching his star to the Trump administration. He desperately wants a break out of the box trade deal and quickly to sort of set the post-Brexit stage. However, it doesn't look like the Americans are responding necessarily in kind over trade or over defending the seizure of their allies' tanker in the Gulf. This is what Secretary of State Pompeo said.
So the responsibility in the first instance falls to the United Kingdom to take care of their ships. But Brian, you know this story. This isn't because of American sanctions. This is because the theocracy, the leadership in Iran, their revolutionary zeal to conduct terror around the world for now four decades continues.
Is that a vote of backing from their strongest ally? What is Britain meant to make of that?
Well, no, it's not, is the answer. And so far as trade is concerned, Christiane, President Trump can promise anything he wants in a trade deal, but it's not for him to deliver. That is very much in the hands of Congress. And Congress will be defending, members of Congress, their own constituents, their districts, their state's interest. Say, we want a deal on farm products, fine. But senators from Iowa, congressmen from other farming states, will try and drive a very hard bargain. Mm-hmm. That's how it is. And no country in the world defends its own interests, its own national interests, more than does America. So we've got to be completely straightforward about this.
Back to Iran, Boris Johnson, and then the historic trails that you track in the English job. You said Boris Johnson did a fairly good job and took advice as foreign secretary. And like all of Europe and most of the world, he agreed with the Iran nuclear deal that it was not perfect, but it was good. However, he is accused of having completely bungled the issue of a British citizen captured, convicted, jailed in Iran, Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe. And he just played right into the hardliners' hands, calling her a journalist when she said she was there to visit her family and she wasn't there for professional reasons. I guess, again, does this fill you with confidence?
Well, there are two Boris Johnsons, is the answer. And the Boris Johnson who was handling the nuclear deal dossier did okay. on Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe. He went to that hearing of the select committee, hadn't read his brief, hadn't thought about it, was busking. And the result of that, and it just happens to be a fact, he's made it much, much more difficult for the decent people in the system to argue in favour of her release, because he said out of his own mouth she was there as a journalist. And you know better than anybody that so far as the Iranian hardliners are concerned, for journalist, read spy. That's what they think. So who can say exactly how much more difficult is made for poor Nazanin? But in my view, it has certainly delayed her release. And the other thing he's got to be really careful about is that if he wants Mrs. Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe to be released, he doesn't want to jump into bed with President Trump.
So to speak. So. Some would say he did jump into bed and did accede to President Trump's demands when he threw a very distinguished British diplomat and ambassador to the USA, Kim Darroch, under the bus after what we understand were very sort of conventional wisdom assessments of the Trump administration and particularly his policy towards Iran.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it was pretty shameful. And now, anybody who's been in Washington for more than 5 minutes will know that senior Republicans say exactly the same thing and worse about President Trump.
Now, let's get to your book here, The English Job, because you talked a moment ago about the relatively good guys in the Iranian system. Of course, many in the United States don't believe that there is such a division. I mean, I know from your writing that a lot of it comes from the post 9/11 moment, your encounter, your visit there with then reform President Mohammad Khatami, the support that the Khatami government gave to the United States and to the West, and the sympathy after 9/11. Describe what the situation. It was a bit of a turning point then.
Well, it was. President Khatami, after 9/11, saw his opportunity, in the best sense of that word. And as you will recall, there were spontaneous demonstrations in Tehran in sympathy for the victims of 9/11 with torchlight processions. So, there was a great opportunity there, which President Khatami saw for Iran to help the US and then to reset its relationships over time with the United States and with the West. And that was why I went out there within 2 weeks to talk to President Khatami about that on our behalf, but indirectly on behalf of the US as well. There are lots of backstairs negotiations between the US and Iran, great deal of cooperation. The Iranians gave huge amount of intelligence cooperation to the international alliance that actually removed the Taliban.
From Afghanistan.
From Afghanistan, without which it would have been much, much more difficult. And things were relatively set fair until you had this disastrous few lines in President Bush's State of the Union speech at the end of January 2002, where he talked about an axis of evil involving North Korea, Iraq and Iran. And I've talked to David Shrum, who was the speechwriter, about this. I mean, he just said, well, I put it in. It was alliterative. It was a few lines. I didn't expect it to survive. Other people, Condi Rice says in her memoirs that she was, and President Bush were taken completely by surprise by the reaction to this. Colin Powell said that when it came round to the State Department, nobody spotted it. You know, it's extraordinary. But in the end, after some weeks of argument, it was the hardliners who won and said, you can never trust the American, you can know the great Satan. And although Iran continued to give some assistance to us in Afghanistan because it was in their interests, there was a great opportunity lost there. Now, we tried to get it back with the nuclear negotiations that I was involved in that started.
Yeah, you started the process.
Yeah, with my French and German counterparts.
So given this, I mean, really rocky, absolutely terrible relationship between Iran and the West, and it's gone back a long time. I mean, even 1953, they blamed the UK for overthrowing their democratically elected Prime Minister Mossadegh. And they see the US and the UK just as perpetual superpower interferers.
Yes. Yeah.
And I want to finish our interview on this personal story. You went back with your wife and friends. You were having a personal holiday tourism to Tehran, to Iran, in 2015. What happened?
Well, in Tehran, it was fine, except that I kept being spotted on the street. It was like being in my district, my constituency, which I was totally unexpected. And people come out to me saying Jackie Straw and asking for selfies. And then between Yazd and Shiraz, this was day six, we stopped off at a famous revered cypress tree, 4,000 years old, just to have a look at it. And there were six guys waiting for me, all dressed in black. And they had prepared a two-page, very detailed document about all the crimes that Britain had committed since the middle of the 19th century, if you please, and said Brits weren't welcome, and I particularly, as a representative of the Cunning Fox, was not welcome there. And what was I doing there? It couldn't possibly be a holiday. That then led, being faced with a hard stop on a motorway, on a highway, where four big guys get out of a car. We didn't know who the devil they were. Our driver is removed. Three of these guys, one carrying a pistol, get into our vehicle. We get off at high speed. We're finally told to transfer into a different people carrier and taken to a completely different hotel. They turned out to be the provincial police on our side. On our side to protect us from the people who put the declaration together, who were the Basij, who are attached to the Revolutionary Guards. And this is the only country in the world where you get police protection, not against criminals or terrorists, which is, you know, what's normal, but against other parts of the same state. It happened again in Isfahan, and in Isfahan we finally said we'll have to cut this short. But we were, despite police protection, it was, unsurprisingly, the Revolutionary Guards and their sidekicks, the Basij, who won. But that also is a parable about the split nature of this government.
Of
this system.
Jack Straw, thank you very much indeed. Author of The English Job.
Thank you very much.
Important reflections there on a vital region that remains volatile today. We turn now to a complicated tale of redemption. Coming from a broken home, Brian Widener found community in the neo-Nazi Vinlanders social group. He was one of the most violent members, immersed in a lifetime of hate and crime. Unfortunately, it's a story that's all too common. Many young men are drawn into the clutches of extremism, often because they're looking for a sense of family and belonging. But Widener made the bold decision eventually to turn his life around. It wasn't an easy feat, considering that he's covered, or he was, from head to toe in racist tattoos. Enter Daryl Lamont Jenkins, a social activist known for helping neo-Nazis leave their circles. Widener's story has now been turned into a film, Skin, with an unrecognizable Jamie Bell in the lead. It's a far cry from his breakout role, Billy Elliot. And here's a clip.
In this business, you've got to stay focused or fall right down the rabbit hole.
What if I take all this stuff off and I'm still a piece of...
I've been speaking to actor Jamie Bell and the actual Daryl Lamont Jenkins, who joined me both from New York. Welcome to the program, Jamie Bell and Daryl Lamont Jenkins.
Thank you so much for having us.
So this is truly a film that you have to have a strong constitution to watch. I mean, it is very difficult, very, very raw, and quite violent, both emotionally and actually physically. I mean, Jamie, let's face it, you come from Billy Elliot and Rocket Man and all sorts of different kinds of productions in the past. How tough was it for you to take on this role?
Certainly my most challenging role that I've ever done. I think when you're portraying someone who is so vastly different from who you are as a person, so intensely, wildly off color as this character is morally to begin with, it is challenging. There's also kind of the physical transformation for the role, you know, to be sitting in the chair for many hours a day, to have all the tattoos on, adding 20 pounds of weight. All that stuff, I think, is actually more easy to deal with. The hardest thing for me to understand was the intense level of detachment that this character had. Detachment from compassion, detachment from empathy, detachment from love. Walking around with that every day for 6 weeks was just very unpleasant.
Okay, so let's bring on our first clip. This is just now Jamie, you playing Brian, and your wife with her three girls.
Thank you, by the way. I use this little bitch, you know, he thinks it's charcoal and that. You wait, coming back to the next one of these? It's gonna be massive.
No, we're done with this.
Yeah.
It's our last gig.
Why?
Why?
Yeah.
I don't want my kids to be around this. We're just here for a paycheck.
Okay, so Jamie, describe now Brian, this white supremacist full of tattoos, and his wife. Is this the turning point when you meet Julie and she decides she can't go to another one of these gatherings with you?
Well, Brian Widener is at this point where we meet him is a career Nazi. That's all he's kind of really done. He's kind of indoctrinated into this ideology, and that was his life, a life of intense drinking, heavy drinking, violence, bigotry, hatred. And then he does come across this, Danny McDonald plays Julie in the film, and she has three girls, as you just saw. And I think there is the spark here that begins his kind of journey out, as well as his relationship with you, Daryl. I think he sees stability. I think he sees in these children the opportunity to be lighter, be someone who maybe can have compassion, and that he challenges himself to look inside. But it's the role for me is a man who is completely unconscious, coming to being awake, kind of reawakening. And Daryl is certainly a huge part of that, but also him becoming a parent to these children. Is also one of the, you know, an intensely motivating factor for him, challenging him to see, does he have these things inside of him, and could he ever be any different?
Okay, well, it's a very relevant conversation, and now I want to play a clip with Daryl's character, and this is where you're explaining to Brian, Jamie Bell, the cost and the modalities of getting out of this life.
I want to help. Feds need your full cooperation on this thing, Brian. Okay? There ain't no deal without it.
I just want to know where we're going to go, where we're going to live, what about the girls?
Look, man, look, all names, of that is classified, okay? Even I won't know unless you want me to.
Well, what about school for the girls?
They will be taken care of, see? I promise you that.
It's been a hard time.
I mean, yeah, especially for...
So, Daryl, that's the actor Mike Colter playing you. What is it? What motivates you, Daryl, in real life to jump in here and to try to save a character like that, take him out of this toxic brew?
Well, the fact that remains that they are still human beings. They don't start off being bigots. They don't start off being hateful. And I would also extend that to people who are in gangs, people who are in cults and such. The thing is, however, is where do we come in? How do we help them? In truth, it all depends on them. I remember Jamie talking about in another interview about how this is not a redemptive story. And it's not. It's all on Brian in this movie. It's all on what he wants to do and where he wants to go with his life. All I can be is a guiding light. I mean, in the beginning of the movie, we're not the best of friends. We are at odds, to underscore a fact. And that's the kind of thing I have to deal with in my day-to-day when I'm dealing with these folks. Either I am fighting them or I am helping them. It all depends on that person.
Well, really interestingly, you are in a way fighting them as well because you have an activist intention. You have a professional organization that actually takes videos and posts them and kind of names and shames and puts them out there when you can get to their meetings. So I guess, how did you enter Brian's life? What was the catalyst for getting, you know, getting Jamie, Brian out of this?
Well, curiously enough, it was actually Julie in real life. It was Julie that contacted us and says, look, we're trying to get out, trying to figure out how to do it. She put me on the phone with Brian after a few conversations with her. And that started the conversation. I haven't had any problems talking to Brian since that day. As he will probably tell you, beforehand, this wouldn't have worked. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was still deep in the Vinlanders, the Vinlander Social Club, as they were called. And I'm straight up Antifa. So there would have been fisticuffs if we saw each other in the street. I would have been concerned about the damage she would have done others. So that's would have been where we were at, were it not for our conversation, were it not for him and Julie saying we want out, we want to advance ourselves in a different direction.
You brought the opposite of detachment into Brian's life, right? Just briefly tell me about how you reintroduced him into his humanity.
Well, basically, one of the things that was important about my initial relationship with Brian was the fact that we didn't talk politics. We didn't talk about our disagreements in that particular sphere. We just talked music. And we talked about what it is that really bonded us and connected us. And it wasn't even a conscious effort on my part. It wasn't a tactic or anything like that. It's who I am. Mm-hmm. And apparently it was who he is. And because of that, because I was able to relate to him on some sort of level, I think it went a long way into him being able to grow himself out of this world that he was living in for 13 years.
Brian is completely marked by his tattoos. In return for information, it looks like you found a donor to remove at least some of the tattoos. And we see this depicted in a 2011 documentary called Erasing Hate. And I just want to play a little clip of the real Brian and the real pain he went through.
The president of the club called me up and said I had to make a choice between either my family or them.
And you get a scar on your face and head?
I was a little intimidated by both of them.
The coming off is frequently more painful than the going on.
How does it get any better?
No, it hurts like hell.
It's all part of the process. Don't like to see him in pain, but everything has a price.
But just to remind us, he would tattoo himself every time he committed, I mean, essentially a hate crime.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And considering how many tattoos he had on his body and still has on his body, that'll give you an idea how bad he was. He was one of the top enforcers of the Villains of Social Club. One of the nastiest individuals out there. I have friends of mine who are still scared of him today. So for him to make this transformation over the past 10, 11 years is remarkable to me. I think it's a testament to him.
And I heard that it was really medically difficult, if not impossible, to remove every single one of them from all over his body. You can see his arms and his torso and everything is painted.
I think, did it take 2 years?
It took about
completely.
2 or 3 years, yeah, yes. Yeah, yeah. Now, he still has some tattoos, but they're not any of the more racially sensitive tattoos, of course. So he still has some on his body. It was just taking too much for that. But I was there for one of the sessions, and I can just tell you, it was intense. Mm. It was definitely intense.
I mean, listen, when you choose to do that to your body, cover it with hate, in an attempt to intimidate people and scare people, to isolate yourself from the world, and then you change your mind, that's, you know, you've put yourself in that position. I'm so kind of glad that we used his treatments as milestones within the film, that I think it was important for me that the character actually goes through some form of physical pain. I really do think that was kind of a crucial element to me in
terms
of the story. I know, you can see it. He's mewing what he chose. But he's also been given a gift. You know, when I went to meet him to research the role and spent a lot of time with him. And when you look at his face, if you didn't know beforehand that this was there, you would never know. I mean, you can kind of see a little like kind of skin discoloration here or there, but you just wouldn't know. So he has been given an opportunity to reclaim his life and change his life forever. And I think when he looks in the mirror, he reckons with the guilt of the things he's done. And he must realize that he's been given just an incredible opportunity to kind of start again.
And what does he do now? What is his life? Where is he?
I mean, you know, he's still dealing with life as he's still going through that redemptive process. And he is somebody that is still also learning. He's still learning about life outside of what he knew for 13 years. Mm-hmm. And we talk every now and again, and we're always joking around about this and that, not just about music, but about about the various things that we see going on, and we're definitely getting a kick out of being in this element.
Mm-hmm. Well, look.
He's been on set with us, too, I should say. He's been on set, and he has helped us along, and me and him both helped the movie along, helping them to understand what it is we were doing out there.
Well, because, look, the fact that it's coming out now means that it is more than just a movie. It's also a political and cultural signpost to the times that we live in. And I wonder whether you both feel that way. Let's just play a mashup of Trump and some of the other politicians over the last week.
As far as I'm concerned, if you hate our country, if you're not happy here, you can leave.
He's launching a blatantly racist attack. This is the agenda of white nationalists. This country belongs to you, mm-hmm. and it belongs to everyone.
Every single member of this institution, Democratic and Republican, should join us in condemning the president's racist tweets.
I think those tweets are racist and xenophobic.
No, I don't think it's racist to say. Was it racist to say love it or leave it?
Stadium was packed. It was a record crowd, and I could have filled it 10 times, as you know. Those are incredible people. Those are incredible patriots.
Whoa. I mean, even now listening to that, send her back and then calling them patriots. I mean, it just goes to show how important this film and the message about it is. So weigh in then. How much do you think it's relevant to today?
It's what we've seen this last week in this country is it looks like it's ripped from the pages of the research I was doing, you know, 50, 60 years ago. I mean, it's to me, it's really terrifying. I hope this film is an urgent fire alarm bell, you know, a wake-up call that this is still happening.
Yeah, and it's exactly why I do what I do and why I and others have been doing this for as long as we have. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that while we're showing clips of our politicians, the clips about Trump, in the end, it's not so much about those politicians, but those people in the rally, for example. Right. It's about us. It's about how we're going to relate to each other. We are going to be the ones who solve our own problems. Those politicians are there because we put them there, and they will leave because we pull them out. That's how that's going to work. What I hope this movie does is show people why that needs to happen and what kind of world we are creating for ourselves and how we can keep it from going in the wrong direction.
Well,
I hope this benefits that conversation in the long run.
I think everybody, I assume everybody hopes that as well. But I must say that, you know, the Daily Stormer, many of these, you know, the 8chan and all the rest of it. I mean, they are really loving all this Trump stuff. Here's what, that it's the most highly trafficked neo-Nazi website. Its founder said, man, President Trump's Twitter account has been pure fire lately. This might be the funniest thing he's ever tweeted. This is the kind of white nationalism we elected him for. And on 8chan, a user said, it is okay for him not to want to be swamped by brown scum that clearly despise him. These invaders have stepped well out of line making demands of us. They don't have to like the way we run things. They can go the hell back. It's up to us, but this is online, you know, ginning up this kind of stuff.
Exactly. It's online. Andrew Anglin hasn't shown his face in public in years. And whoever's on Reddit is anonymous. The fact that they have to resort to just being as far away from us as possible to avoid the conflicts, to avoid that opposition, is a testament to us, is a testament to what it is we want and what it is we will reject when we see it. So when you see it online, be ready for it, combat it. But remember that we are still decent people. We are still in a good place. We just have to stay there.
Mm-hmm. Look, skin is not just about hate and neo-Nazis. I mean, the people who are in these groups often talk about family, of being feeling validated, of feeling that somebody's out there to, you know, bring them in when they feel alienated. And that's not an unusual thought. We just had on our program a young writer, Jamil Givani, who's written Why Young Men, and he told Michelle Martin what drew him to gang culture as a youth.
Society was just rigged against people like me. I didn't think that I had, like, there was no meritocracy in my mind. So what's the point of working at school if you think people don't want you to be successful? They're not going to give you a job. When you go to the mall, you get followed around by security guards. it all added up to this feeling of, I'm not destined for success here, so why bother?
So, Daryl, I mean, the alienation and the feeling of validation and family in some of these hate-filled groups.
Yeah, and I think that there is a parallel between, as I pointed out before, whether or not you go into white power crews or whether or not you go into some garden variety street gang, if you get yourself involved in a cult, if you're radicalized in some fashion, you can go in that direction or you can go in a more positive direction, join a positive church or what have you. I think it all depends on how much we are reaching out to those that are feeling that baggage, feeling like their lives aren't worth a damn. That's really what, who we're dealing with initially. One of the important things in the movie is that there's a character named Gavin. And he said that the reason why he was in the movie, and I don't want to spoil it, I don't think it's a spoiler or anything like that, but he said the reason why he joined the group was because he was hungry. He was in the street when they found him.
Wow.
And I spoke to somebody about that scene a while back, and that took their breath away, because that's exactly what it is we're dealing with.
Well, it's a remarkable story at a remarkable time. So Daryl Lamont Jenkins, founder of the One People's Project, and Jamie Bell, who plays Brian Widner, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
It's uncomfortable, but surely a much-watched film that's out in selected cinemas across the United States today. Our next guest is the Wall Street Journal's editor-in-chief, Matt Murray. Taking over the paper in 2018, Murray has since been working tirelessly to win back the dwindling public trust in the news media. He sat down with our Walter Isaacson to discuss the ongoing challenges facing journalists today and celebrating 130 years of the Wall Street Journal in print.
Matt, thank you for being with us.
Well, thanks, Walter, for having me for your first. It's great to be here with you. I really appreciate it.
You know, the Wall Street Journal has one of the most trusted names in media, according to surveys. But in some ways, that's like being the highest mountain in Louisiana. The trust in the media has collapsed so much. Why is that happening, and how do you fight that?
It's a challenge, and I think the media has to take very seriously that we have a major, major trust problem among ourselves. So, yes, as you say, I'm happy that in most surveys we are at the top or right near the top as trusted, but the whole media has slid. I mean, look, I think it's things we know. Technology has driven more polarization in how we consume content and awareness of content. I think that's been a real challenge for us. Obviously, lots of politicians and executives, the president being the foremost example, but not the only example, have found that they can just beat about the media for whatever we write, deny anything is truthful that they don't like. Generally, of course, often the rule is the more truthful it is, the more abuse you get. And that's been accepted by people in this polarized world. And look, I personally think to some extent there are self-inflicted wounds here that we have to take seriously on our part. You know, there's been a move in certainly mainstream daily news reporting of the kind that the Wall Street Journal does. There's been a move toward, so embracing audience data that I think we're getting too opinionated sometimes in our news. We're confusing opinion and fact too often, or there's strong points of view in a lot of stories that I think are aimed often with good intentions to engage an audience, but have the risk of only speaking to part of the audience out there, and that leaves some of the rest of the audience feeling alienated. One more thing I'll say is I think when we make mistakes, and we do, journalism is a human enterprise, we as an industry have to be very forthright about them, own up to them, talk about them, admit them, explain what we do. We're not very transparent. You know, we are suffering the same kind of loss of faith in institutions that every institution is suffering, but we're not always helping ourselves.
Do you think that the media has moved away from a concept of objectivity and a desire or belief that you can actually do objective reporting?
I think corners of it have. And look, I want to be clear that there's always, of course, room for a very robust media environment with, you know, opinion journalism and point of view and different elements. But I think that in the core where you want objective, straight news, and you declare that that's your intention, I think at times, yeah, it's been harder to find that. Understandably, in some ways, because some of the pressures of today and the challenges of covering the president sometimes test everybody's objectivity and the challenge of being in the middle. And finding an audience in the middle some ways is harder these days than it might have been in the past. But I do think also there are people who think a point of view is truthful, that the idea of objectivity is a bit of a canard, that nobody's truly objective, so embrace your point of view.
You don't believe that, do you?
I think if you declare that that's what you're doing and you admit that you have it and you're transparent about it, I can accept that. The challenge I have is if you're going to be objective and play it straight, you've got to really strive to do that, which includes an awareness of your own biases and how you accommodate them.
You said that the age of Trump and Trump himself makes it harder to just stay on the straight and narrow and be objective.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, because he likes to put us on the playing field, the press, not the Wall Street Journal particularly, but he likes to make an issue of us. And he has a habit sometimes, as we know, of saying things and then when they're reported saying, I didn't say that, or I was mischaracterized, or wanting to use us as a hobby horse. And I think it's a game that he plays with us. And so the challenge, I think, is to cover him fairly and accurately, hold your ground. But look, the president sometimes wants to pull you down there in the mud, and I think others are learning that habit from him a little bit.
Your predecessor was sometimes criticized within your own newsroom and sort of it tamped down morale, people said, by edging and trying to keep it more in the more pro-Trump or not as anti-Trump as the rest of the press. Do you feel that's something you have to wrestle with, and how do you handle that? Does your staff sometimes push you and say, hey, how come we can't use the word racist or use the word lies?
I think that the first six months or a year of the president's term provoked a lot of discussion, a lot of newsrooms, and caused a lot of challenges for everybody. And he's such a unique figure in some ways. One of the challenges sometimes, of course, is he has a habit of tweeting outrageous things, and then you go write the tweet, but you don't want to take your eye off the policy over here. So you don't always want to give attention to every outrageous thing. Look, he's a master of media. He probably understands the things that punch media's buttons better than certainly any president we've seen in our lifetimes, I think. And he's good at it. So he knows what organizations will do to get clicks and readers and what TV viewers. He's good at that. So I think everybody wrestled with that. And I think, I was deputy at the Wall Street Journal, so I was part of it. I think it was about all of us and not just my predecessor. So, you know, my judgment is we did pretty well in the end on not falling into those traps. And I think actually, I'm not going to, name, I think some people went a little far in the other direction of sort of
other
anti-Trump. Yes, very anti-Trump all the time in a way that, was not, I don't know that the reporting always backed up the assertions, I would say. My predecessor also was the one who signed off on the Michael Cohen coverage and supported that and ran the early stories on Michael Cohen, which led to the entire investigation on Cohen. It's still the only reporting line from any major publication that's implicated the president directly in the commission of a crime. We won the Pulitzer Prize for it this year. And, I've been in the job and I get credit for that. But my predecessor, Jerry, deserves the credit for a lot of that work. So I think what we were going through was being felt in other newsrooms, too.
Give me an example, recently, of a meeting you had to have in the newsroom where you had to sort something out and figure out how do we play this straight?
Yeah, we spent a lot of time last week when the president sent out his initial tweets on the squad about whether or not to term them racist, which was a big discussion in a lot of newsrooms. And, it was a very typical kind of a Trump tweet where he walked right up to the line, didn't overtly necessarily in the eyes of some people overtly used explicitly racist language. Some people characterize it as xenophobic because go back where you came from has been used for Irish and Germans and others in American history. So I think on the first day we described it in a headline on the front page as racially charged. I think we actually went furthest of the big papers in putting race in the headline on the first day. But there was a lot of debate and discussion in the journalism world about whether to call it racist and how far to push it. And I think people felt good about how we did it, but we continued to have a discussion with reporters in our Washington bureau and talk about it amongst ourselves. There are people of color in the newsroom that we talked to, and every single person I solicited and asked what they thought, they said, from my experience, it's it's not even a close call. You know, I've heard that all my life. And eventually,
meaning it's racist.
It's racist. And so, you know, we ended up using the word to describe the tweets. And this came about after a lot of discussion and debate amongst ourselves. And so I think you have to have a newsroom that has those kind of conversations as you run into these issues and as the world evolves today.
The American economy has been booming for almost a decade now. And yet there's this big populist and resentment backlash or feeling of discomfort. Why is that?
Well, I think the middle class and the working class in the United States was battered for a long time, even prior to the financial crisis. Our economics editor at the time was writing stories which we weren't always, we didn't know at the time how spot on he was, about how much of the economy in the aughts year, in the aughts and the Bush years, was fueled by credit and home equity loans and people borrowing, but that real wages and real growth had really stagnated around 1999. And then, of course, you throw in China, and it's clear that as the Chinese economy took off, a lot of jobs did go overseas to China and did go overseas to Mexico, and something was happening there. Then you get the meltdown hits all of us. Unemployment shoots very high. A lot of people lost their houses. A lot of people took big hits on their credit. And I think there are just deep scars, deep traumas on a lot of people out there that are still with us. I think there's little doubt that a lot of people who were feeling battered 5 years ago are feeling much better today and should be feeling much better today. But I think there's still an air of contingency about some of it for some people, and they're still making up ground that was lost.
You've often said that Rupert Murdoch doesn't interfere with your way of guiding the editorial product. But what sort of guidance, what sort of involvement does Rupert Murdoch, and for that matter, News Corp, have in setting the direction of the Wall Street Journal?
So since I've been in the job and then when I've interacted with them, I have to say they've genuinely have been hands-off on guiding on any stories or story selection or how to play particular stories. I really get no guidance on that. And in fact, have been told explicitly, you're the editor, your decision. Rupert does have, I think, strong feelings about having a newspaper and a product that's lively and engaging. So, you know, he's a believer that often our stories are too long and that people lose interest quickly and that you can see it in the data. So say what you want to say, get out and move on. I think we've been owned by News Corp. I've been there 25 years and we've been owned by News Corp for almost 12 years now. So, you know, the Wall Street Journal did not really use much art prior to their acquisition, and they have big thoughts about photography and creative use of art and the engaging visual sensibility, which we've developed by leaps and bounds in the last 12 years. So, you know, thinking about the drama photography, the splash of the front page, those kinds of mm-hmm. things, sort of the component, the classic components of an exciting newspaper that way. So I'll hear thoughts on that. And being engaging, grabbing attention, making people want to sit down and really read you and compel their attention and not taking it for granted. I mean, there's a lot of that, mm-hmm. which is useful in translating to how we think about the digital product as well in the same way.
Let me ask about a few things that could worry you, and you tell me which worries you the most. The federal deficit.
I think it's worrying. I think we've crossed a point here, too, where there isn't anybody in either party really holding up the flag for the deficit. I think both parties have crossed a line in their openness to building the deficit up more and more and more, and I think that will catch up to us eventually.
A trade skirmish with China.
You know, I think we're seeing some effects of the trade skirmish right now on us. I think probably we'll get a deal of some kind. It might be a more modest deal, not a transformative deal. And I think we've actually absorbed it so far a little better than I would have predicted a year ago. I'm cautious on making predictions. But obviously an extended, kind of very distant, ongoing trade battle would have real effects on both countries. And I think we probably are, and in some ways maybe with good reason, we probably are headed to a permanent recalibration of the economic relationship between the United States and China, even if we get a deal here on the immediate trade stuff.
a crisis with Iran, a war with Iran, and maybe an oil crisis that would come from that?
I hate to sound cavalier about something that I think is a risk. I think the risk with Iran is probably more of an accidental thing that happens that sets off a larger thing. But I think right now, I think there's a kind of a calculated escalation gamesmanship going on here that probably is resolvable in some way at some point.
And what other things worry you about the economy? What do you sort of tell your reporters, hey, we better keep an eye on this?
Well, I think that, I think a lot of people are still left out of the prosperity of the United States and the economy in the United States today in ways that not all of us fully understand and fully realize. You know, people have been, I was reading this book, Dignity, that just came out by Chris Arnade, who I don't know, but that's getting some attention. And you think about some of the other books and think pieces about what they call the Trump voter, and some of that can be a bit simplistic. But nonetheless, you know, there's no doubt that there's a lot of hollowed-out towns in America that were prosperous towns 30 or 40 years ago. There's no doubt that there's a lot of people without access to proper educational systems or opportunities to move up and who feel very left out, who are vulnerable in the country. And at the same time, I think you've got New York and San Francisco and other cities getting more and more concentrated and more and more expensive, and in some ways harder and harder to break into for many people and harder to understand. And I worry about that divide, as many people do who are much smarter than I am about it a lot. I think, you know, are we really in a place of two economies for many people? I think that's something that should concern all of us. How do we bring more Americans on board? You know, I mean, if I've heard people talk about this. If you could raise everybody's credit score in the United States by 50 points and you could bring them more into the economy, it would be great for them and more prosperity for all of us. And I worry that we don't know how to do that. We don't have answers for those people anymore. And I think some of our politics reflects maybe sometimes a sense that there's a finite pie and we're grabbing for pieces of it. I don't know how we make the pie bigger for everybody. I think that's a concern.
Your father became a monk, and you wrote a book about it.
And a priest.
And a priest. Tell me how that affected your view of your purpose in life.
It's an interesting question. My parents were both writers, which had an influence on me. And then my mother died when I was seven, and my father retired early from his job in the government. I grew up in Washington. And he felt he had a calling, and he became religious as I was in high school. And after I went to college, he ended up going to Central Illinois to take vows in the monastery. Went to seminary for 4 years and became a priest. Spent the last 18 years of his life as a priest in this area. You know, I guess the ways that it influenced me in ways I wasn't conscious of always at the time was a strong desire that my father had to have purpose and meaning in life and to pursue meaning and to actively pursue meaning and particularly to do something meaningful, engage with other people and really over time in the service of other people. You know, my father was an extraordinarily generous person to others with his time, far more than I am. And I think the example he set for me of putting others first and sort of pursuing what for him was the ultimate meaning and importance was a pretty strong example for me to try to, you know, not just think about the what you're doing today or the immediate task in front of you, but about doing something meaningful and really always remembering that you're working with human beings in front of you, whatever the circumstances, whether you're writing hard stories about them, which we do a lot times at the journal, whether you're having meetings with them, whether they're working for you, whether they're your bosses, try always to think about the personal human interaction and the meaning of two individuals coming together. So I hope I've got some of that from him.
Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
See you.
And that's it for now. Remember, you can always listen to our podcast, see us online at amanpour.com, and you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter. Thanks for watching, and goodbye from London.